from KQED.
Support for the California Report comes from Digital Foundry, building digital capabilities for leading organizations around the world. More online at digitalfoundry.com. Eric and Wendy Schmidt, whose family foundation advances the wiser use of energy and natural resources on a planet where everything is connected. On the web at theschmidt.org. And the California Endowment, working to achieve health and justice for all. Learn more at calendow.org.
On today's California Report magazine, we hop aboard a boat to look for shipwrecks, lost treasures that give us clues about life 100 years ago on the California coast.
It reminds me that the people that came before us were courageous, and they were adaptable, and they were creative. And it gives me hope that we will be too.
And we meet a family from Lake County who somehow seems unbelievably hopeful, despite the fact that they've just lost everything they own.
It's going to take a lot of polishing to get that silver lining out of this, but it's in there somewhere.
Plus, getting burned out on Burning Man.
The fire-breathing octopus, seen it. The women's topless bike ride, done it. Playing Beethoven with a full orchestra and 200 kazoos. Did that too.
I'm Sasha Coca, and this is the California Report magazine. If you happen to be driving up Highway 395 on the east side of the Sierra recently, you might have noticed something strange. A Boeing 747 making its way by land up the spine of California. Reporter Susan Vallett tells us the plane is headed to Burning Man, the week-long celebration of outsider art and culture that starts this weekend in the Nevada desert.
At the Mojave Air and Spaceport between Bakersfield and Barstow, a forklift moves a metal beam into place to transport this 80s-era 747. It used to lie in the adjoining Mojave Boneyard, a junkyard and roadside attraction for decommissioned planes. The inside looks ready for cargo, cavernous and cleared of seats, metal ribs exposed. Volunteers have worked for months to transform this into what they hope will be the world's largest mobile art installation. The tail's been sliced off, the wings have been clipped. Project creator Ken Feldman says only the top half of the plane, all that was the cabin area, will go to Burning Man this year, phase one of the 747 project. The goal is to get the whole thing up there, half a football field long and three stories tall.
How do you eat an elephant? A little bit at a time.
Feldman's the CEO of Big Imagination, the nonprofit arts foundation that's funding this project with a crowdsourcing campaign. Feldman says the plane will be decorated with lights, with DJs and dancing inside.
You come up through the cargo bay and you come to another staircase, and on top of that is the insecurity checkpoint, where our TSA agents, touching sensitive areas, will patch you down, help you get rid of your insecurities. Then you move to the baggage check, where another flight attendant will ask you, do you have any emotional baggage that you need to drop off?
Then it's on to the boarding zone, where a flight attendant asks you where you're going.
And if someone says, oh, I want to go to Disneyland, it's like, no, where are you going in life? Where do you want to go? And we give you a boarding pass where you write down on the boarding pass where you are headed. And you then staple gun up on a wall that's called the destination wall.
Feldman says the idea is to use this interactive art to inspire people to dream big, like the plane itself.
It's not just an art exhibit in an airplane. The airplane is the art exhibit.
That's volunteer Nick Avila of San Francisco, who's using his engineering skills to fix up the cockpit.
All this stuff is hopefully going to work. Like, you can come and pull the throttle up, down. You can move the, probably shouldn't move the landing gear thing, but you can move that around.
Avila says the 747 project is part of the Burning Man tradition of art cars, or mutant vehicles. Anything with wheels made to look like pirate ships, dragons, unicorns. He says he loves the ridiculousness of the ideas.
To me, it's about bringing cool things out that you built for no real reason other than just to bring it there and share it with people.
Next year, they'll bring up the bottom half of the plane, bolt it back to the top, and drive it around the dusty desert at Burning Man with an airport tug. For the California Report, I'm Susan Vallett in the Mojave Desert.
Every year, about 70,000 people gather at Burning Man. In fact, a whole temporary metropolis rises in the desert called Black Rock City. The California Report's April Demboski will be there, too. She's been making the annual pilgrimage for most of her adult life. But after 15 years, she says the glow is starting to fade.
As I sit down to write this, my husband is wielding a razor blade over a huge swatch of white fur. The end goal is a coat that he can wear on our friend's polar bear art car.
Ow.
The rest of our apartment is besieged by dusty bins full of batteries, baby wipes, and silver jumpsuits. Somehow, we will cram them all into a four-door sedan and make the seven-hour trek to the desert. If I don't sound excited, it's because I'm not. This will be my 15th year at Burning Man, and I'm over it. So many things about the event that used to fill me with delight have just become part of the backdrop. The fire-breathing octopus, seen it. The women's topless bike ride, done it. Playing Beethoven with a full orchestra and 200 kazoos, did that too. What was once wild and crazy isn't wild and crazy anymore. It's normal. I feel sad and kind of embarrassed by this. I've built up a tolerance to the extraordinary. And no matter how bizarre and weird it gets out there, it's now just ordinary. But there's also something kind of amazing about this. I was 23 when I first went to Burning Man, and it was nothing less than life-changing. Black Rock City was the opposite of where I grew up. Be conventional was basically the town motto. At Black Rock City, it's more like be a radical nonconformist.
There's the very first time that each new burner gets on their bike or jumps on in our car at night and they ride out into the darkness of the playa.
This is my friend Jack Thorpe. We camp together at Burning Man.
And there's lasers and there's distant thumping of dance domes. And that first time you do it is like seeing New York for the first time. It's like going to the Grand Canyon. You're never gonna see that again.
For me, it wasn't just the party. My first year at Burning Man, I experienced acceptance and lack of judgment in a way I never had before. The event shattered so many preconceived notions I had about people and beauty and relationships. It's impossible for me to parse out every Burning Man revelation from who I've become today, but I can say the guy I married, the career I've chosen, all have roots in this social experiment in the desert. But now, when I look at that white fur scattered around my apartment, I'm filled with dread.
Take a break!
That's what Jack did.
My third year, I remember riding out into that darkness and looking back and sort of having that feeling like, I've seen this before.
After taking a year off, he came back with a new approach. He refocused his attention on our camp and our friends.
I think the conundrum is, how do you... And you could just apply this to anything in your life. You know, how do you maintain a freshness and a sense of innocence and discovery for something when you're doing it over and over and over again?
That sounds like marriage.
Oh, yes. Yes. And I'm sorry, is my wife listening to this?
Okay, he's not saying take a break from your marriage to keep it fresh.
It's more about feeling more satisfied on what is really like an emotionally deeper level than just that, you know, oh my God, it blew me away.
My husband Alex and I have been together for 15 years, as long as we've been going to Burning Man. It's a very special place for us. But after this year, he's in agreement. It's time to take a break.
We're taking the spirit of Burning Man with us. We're going to go off and do some different adventure that also instills us with a sense of awe and wonder and excitement.
For now, I decided to buy a white fur coat, just like Alex's. We'll ride the polar bear car together and cruise the Black Rock City skyline one last time. For the California Report, I'm April Demboski. We'll be right back.
This week, scientists uncovered a shipwreck about 30 miles off the coast of San Francisco. It sat underwater for more than half a century.
So we are now 35 meters away.
Remotely operated vessels, the same ones that explored the Titanic back in 2004, live streamed a video feed from 2,600 feet under the ocean.
Okay, vessel in sight.
And then the hull of the old World War II era aircraft carrier came into focus.
First eyes on Independence in 65 years.
Oh my God. Wow.
The Independence last saw combat in 1944 near the Philippines. After the war, the Navy used the ship as a target to test the impacts of nuclear weapons at Bikini Atoll. The ship was heavily damaged and eventually deliberately sunk back in 1951, not far from the Farallon Islands off San Francisco. But now, scientists have discovered many of the ship's features still intact.
Jim, you think we're looking at the 40-millimeter gun platform?
Could be. Could be. It has that shape right there aft, yeah.
Some of these same shipwreck explorers have also been working a little further north along the California coast, uncovering traces of the state's redwood logging history. KQED's Danielle Venton brings us the story from aboard a boat on the Pacific.
Deborah Marks leaps from a catamaran into the waters off the coast of Gersel Cove, about 100 miles north of San Francisco. She and her colleague Matthew Lawrence both work as marine archaeologists with the National Oceanic and Atmospheric Administration, or NOAA. Lawrence points out the target.
So that's where we believe there's a potential artifact to investigate. We think it might be an anchor or something like that.
About an hour later, Marks and her diving partner, Jean Marignac, come out.
Divers up, 1521. Divers up, 1521.
Dripping. They came across underwater life.
Big fish.
Probably lingcod. And some sea urchins, but
nothing man-made. Looked like maybe some, there's like some weird, like that's aluminum pipe sort of thing. Good dive, though. They look pretty.
Yeah.
That's how treasure hunting goes sometimes. The treasures, in this case, are remnants of the early logging and ranching era along a 30-mile stretch of the rugged Sonoma County coastline, between Duncan's Landing to the south and Gualala to the north. Deborah Marks shares some history.
And I don't know if the average person living here today realizes what an active area this was back in the 19th century and turn of the century. Schooners were traveling up and down the coast, shipping this lumber mainly to San Francisco.
Sonoma and Mendocino redwoods ended up everywhere.
And then it was moved on to larger vessels and shipped all over the world. They shipped it to Hong Kong, they shipped it to China, Australia, South America, and so our lumber industry here really fueled the development of lots of these countries.
People wanted redwood because it resists rot.
And this was essential for building of the railroads. You wanted a very durable hardwood that would last, especially in the hot, humid conditions in, you know, places like South America.
To support that industry, tiny ports popped up along the coast. They were known as doghole ports.
So called because a dog could just barely get in and back out.
James Delgado is the director of NOAA's Maritime Heritage Program. At these spots, some with great names like Hard Scratch Signal or Rough and Ready Cove, loggers and mariners set up elaborate timber chutes, a technology developed for the gold rush but perfected here. It was to transfer cargo from the shore directly to the deck of a ship anchored near the coast at a mooring. It was easy for things to go wrong.
Where accidents tend to happen is, you know, these days, it's at the entrance to the parking lot, if you will. Most benders happen there, and in shipping days, going in and out of port was the most dangerous place.
Typically, the crew and passengers could make it to the shore just fine, but many boats went down.
If you're anchored in and a storm comes up, then you're going to get pushed into the rocks. And in that way, a lot of these ships were lost.
As archaeologists searched the National Archive and old news clippings, they found nearly 100 shipwrecks recorded along this piece of coast. Their survey this month searched for and mapped the remnants of these doghole ports, wrecks, anchors, and timber chutes. But searching for old shipwrecks, especially the ones that have been battered by storms and waves, isn't quite like you might imagine, says Ken Kramer, diving safety officer for California State Parks.
You know, with the ruggedness of the coast and the type of exposure to waves, it's very unlikely that you find anything fully intact or even partially intact.
Just last year, NOAA expanded its oversight to include the Sonoma and southern Mendocino coast as part of the Greater Farallon's National Marine Sanctuary. Breck Partman, senior state archaeologist, helps manage sites like Fort Ross Historic State Park, where divers looked for shipwrecks. He says the partnership with NOAA gives the region a chance
to do a type of archaeology that we just haven't had a chance to do,
especially the underwater exploration. Parkman looks around him and thinks about the people who lived and worked along this often treacherous coastline.
It reminds me that the people that came before us were courageous, and they were adaptable, and they were creative. And it gives me hope that we will be too.
Footage from the dives and maps will be available to the public through the Greater Fairlawn's National Marine Sanctuary website in the coming months. For the California Report, I'm Danielle Venton on the Sonoma Coast.
Every month on our show, we check in on the latest music releases with roots in the Golden State. The California Report's Susie Racho is here to talk with our pop music critic Steve Hockman about an LA group that's reemerged after a decade and some bands with intriguing frontmen.
Welcome, Steve.
Hello, Susie.
Well, we've got a couple of mysterious releases to talk about. Let's start with the always intriguing LA musician Vinyl Williams. Vinyl Williams' new album is called Brunei, and he's somebody with a really diverse, I don't even know if diverse is enough, really, but diverse creative background. He's not just a musician, but he's a visual artist as well.
And Susie, you're planning your vacation for the star of Al-Nilam, right? Out in the Orion constellation?
I know, he's obsessed with it, right?
It's kind of this internal sci-fi sort of thing, which maybe fits because his grandfather, John Williams, the Star Wars composer, among many other things. So maybe he grew up with that kind of sensibility, but he says that's the inspiration for his art, his visual art, and for his music.
So how does that sound?
Well, it sounds a little more earthly in the sense that his biggest musical inspiration seems to be coming from Germany and France. We hear a lot of krautrock and kraftwerk, and a lot of his stuff, and especially with his sort of breathy vocals, sounds to me like the band Stereolab, though the words are kind of ambient space words to some extent, but I'm finding this pretty captivating, to be honest.
That's Vinyl Williams. His new album is called Brunei. Up next, we decipher the mysterious sounds of the album leaf. That is the album leaf from their latest Between Waves. The album leaf has been Jimmy LaValle's solo venture for a long time, but now it's a band starting with this record. Has anything changed?
Not dramatically. I mean, we're kind of in an ambient textural mode today, it seems, with Vinyl Williams and the album leaf. Jimmy LaValle from San Diego as the album leaf, sometimes with a band, sometimes solo, has always done this sort of pastoral ambient sound.
This is the first album in 6 years for the album leaf, and it kind of continues this very ambient, mostly instrumental. But, you know, when he sings, I think you pay attention just because his vocals aren't, you know, they're not on a lot of songs.
Right. There's several songs on this album that he does sing on, and there's kind of an 80s kind of sense to it in some ways. I think about, like, Tears for Fears or something like that. Maybe not quite as dramatic as they could get, but this kind of sense of an aspirational mood, kind of like we're exploring our emotions and we're trying to figure out who we are and where we are and all that. And there's one song, Never Far, that has a kind of a yearning vocal to it. And it closes with the title song, Between Waves, another one of those where we're sort of between action and stillness in the title. even though it's got its mechanical sound, it's also very human and very moving. Moonlight fades from my side, sunshine blinds my eyes. Nightmares running through my mind, sunlight.
That is the album Leaf from their latest, Between Waves. And before we go, I know you want to talk about a release that's coming in September. This is a band from LA that hasn't had a record or release in 10 years. This is The Tide, that's T-Y-D-E, and as that Y might indicate, there's a lot that goes back to the 60s in this. We started out in the constellation Orion, now we're going to finish in the constellation of the L.A. Canyons. Darren Rademacher, who was in Beechwood Sparks, which maybe was a little ahead of its time in L.A. 10, 15, 20 years ago, doing the sort of Buffalo Springfield-inspired kind of sound and all that. Now there are other groups like Dawes that have really taken that into new places. But Beechwood Sparks kind of laid the groundwork for that, for a new generation. And Darren was part of that. And he's, as The Tide, he's been doing his own spin on that and taking it into slightly different directions as well. Steve Hockman is the California Report's pop music critic. He has more on the releases from The Tide, the album Leaf, and Vinyl Williams at californiareport.org. Thanks, Steve.
Thank you, Susie.
Here at the California Report, we've had a busy few weeks covering wildfires. We've sent our reporters out to evacuation centers, fire command posts, and to talk to people who've lost their homes across the state.
In the worst of situations, I've seen the best come out in the community.
That's Mark Gilariducci, the head of California's Office of Emergency Services, on the streets of Lower Lake, a tiny town in Lake County ravaged by the recent Clayton fire.
This is a resilient community, and collectively, we're gonna work together to make it as good as it ever was in the past.
It seems like an easy soundbite, this optimistic view about bouncing back from tragedy. Resilience has become a kind of buzzword in schools, among social activists, and of course, after natural disasters. But sometimes you meet people who really do embody this concept of resilience. KQED science editor Craig Miller did as he was reporting amid the ashes of Main Street in Lower Lake.
When I met the Skidmore family, fire crews were still hosing down hot spots on what remained of their property. The first thing Michael Skidmore said to me was, "Welcome to Lower Lake."
You're about a week late. It was much nicer last week.
Somehow, surrounded by gray ruins, Michael's sense of humor wasn't the only thing intact. His 4-star auto repair shop still stood with what looked like minor damage. But up and back, the family home was simply gone. Little left among the ashes to even indicate home. The remains of a water heater, some metal chair frames, the skeleton of a pickup truck. Also gone, 8 cabins they rented out to other Lower Lake residents.
We worked really hard 5 years to restore those cabins.
Michael's wife, Star.
They were white with blue trim to match the shop and white picket fences around each one. And
so they'd been here for about 100 years, but dry cedar boy howdy, these tinder boxes. I was running out the front door and these were popping into flames. It was scary.
Next door, both the home and business were a total loss. It was the local VW shop, and the properties littered with the charred husks of cars, many trailing puddles of melted aluminum wheels.
The firemen were on top of that building trying to put the fire out. They obviously failed, but they were giving it a hell of a try, that's for sure.
Hours earlier, I had seen some firefighters sifting through the ashes next door. Joe Morrison and his Sonoma County team were among those who tried to save this block of Main Street.
This happened super fast. We did our best to make a stand here, and then this one was, we couldn't even stand here. The heat was so intense, so fast. We had to cut and run.
Michael and Star's granddaughter, Grace, lives with them. She recalls how the fire took everybody by surprise.
Everybody was trying to assure us that no, it would not get down into Lower Lake. They were going to take control of it way before that. And then next thing you know, there's a tree that in the back that burst into flame, dropped on the ground, and the fire was coming down the hill at us, and we were running out of there.
Now they were back with the ruins still smoking, and Grace was looking for her three cats.
My three kitties. There's Boy, he's black, and one of his teeth are chipped.
As Grace described her pride of cats with a 15-year-old optimism that they'd be found, no one wanted to disabuse her.
With no tail, and she's very friendly.
I'm not going to cry. I'll be doing that the rest of forever. No, I'm going to, got to move on.
And for this family, moving on means staying put. It wasn't even up for discussion.
I got to rebuild, and the funds got to come from somewhere.
Though that will be challenging. The Skidmores say the insurance on the home and cabins might have lapsed. The shop survived, but now it's all they've got.
I got my job, I'm going to keep working, but, you know, where's my customer base? You know, their ashes. Hey, it's going to take a lot of polishing to get that silver lining out of this, but it's in there somewhere.
It's not hard to see where Grace gets her resilience.
This is just going to bring Lower Lake closer together. I mean, we were already pretty close from the Rocky Fire and the Valley Fire, but this is just another step to just closeness.
As of a week after the fire, they had not found the cats. They're still looking for housing, but Star says God's got this. For the California Report, I'm Craig Miller in Lake County.
And that's the California Report magazine, a production of KQED Public Radio in San Francisco. You can listen to us wherever you are. Subscribe to our podcast and let us know what you think about the show on our Facebook page or send us a note, calreport@kqed.org. Our director is Susie Racho. The technical producer is Seal Muller, with additional engineering from Howard Gelman. David Marks is the online producer. Our interns are Eli Wertschafter and Lacey Jane Roberts. The California Report's senior editor is Victoria Maulione. And our editorial team includes Polly Stryker, Stephen Cuevas, Ingrid Becker, and Holly Kernan. I'm Sasha Coca. Thanks for listening. This is the California Report magazine.
Support for the California Report comes from the Wesley Foundation, improving the lives of California's children and youth at risk. The James Irvine Foundation, expanding economic and political opportunity for Californians who are working but struggling with poverty. More at irvine.org. And Eric and Wendy Schmidt, whose family foundation advances the wiser use of energy and natural resources on a planet where everything is connected. On the web at theschmidt.org.